From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the shutdown forces one family to make hard decisions.
Today I got a call from my doctor about an appointment. I will postpone all medical appointments because I don't have the copay to give them.
And Representative Catherine Clark with the latest on the negotiations from Washington.
This wall has become a symbol, and it is not part of a realistic, data-driven approach to keeping our borders secure.
Also today, Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards on her latest proposal to tax high-end developments to create more affordable housing. And 100 years ago today, a molasses tank in the North End violently exploded.
People remembered what sounded like machine gun fire as the rivets were popping off of this tank. And this flood of molasses killed 21 people. This is a disaster.
That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. This broadcast was recorded earlier today. We begin with a special report from London, where Parliament voted down Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it has been an historic day in London. Just in the last hour, the British Parliament has voted against Prime Minister Theresa May's divorce deal with the European Union. Here is what it sounded like when the vote was announced.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
The vote followed hours of impassioned debate and came more than 2 years after the British people narrowly approved a referendum to leave the EU. Joining us now with the latest is NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, this was decisive, a big defeat for Theresa May. How did it play out?
Well, way beyond decisive. This was historic, which isn't an easy thing to say in a country like the United Kingdom. Historians were scrambling for something equivalent. They had to go back to the 1920s when government lost a vote by 166. This was well over 200. So it was a stunning defeat. I think that we knew it was coming. I don't think we were certain it was going to be this big.
Okay, well, let's listen to the Prime Minister, how she reacted right after the vote.
The government has heard what the House has said tonight. But I ask members on all sides of the House to listen to the British people who want this issue settled and to work with the government to do just that.
Okay, and here is the Labour Party leader, the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
The result of tonight's vote is the greatest defeat for a government since the 1920s in this House. This is a catastrophic defeat for this government. After 2 years of failed negotiations, the House of Commons has delivered its verdict on her Brexit deal, and that verdict is absolutely decisive.
Frank, what happens now?
That's a great question. So Jeremy Corbyn, as you've heard, he wants to have a vote of no confidence. The Prime Minister welcomed that, and there's going to be a debate tomorrow here at the House of Commons. And there'll be a vote perhaps in the evening. Now, in ordinary circumstances, Jeremy, this prime minister, most prime ministers would never survive this. But as we know, Brexit is nothing, there's nothing ordinary about it. It seems, from what we can hear so far, is that she still has the support of her party to stay in office and from the Democratic Unionist Party, which is propping it up in Parliament. So it's expected that, in fact, even though this is an incredible defeat, that she is more or less expected right now to survive tomorrow night.
She may survive. What about the idea of Brexit? Is it now much more likely that there is, as many have been calling for, going to be a second referendum on the issue?
There has been more talk of that. 6 weeks ago, it seemed very, very unlikely, but in part because the government cannot come up with any kind of solution to how to leave the European Union in a way that they can get a majority for in Parliament. It is increasingly a possibility. Now, that said, it's very tricky. The parliament here is very different. I got a lesson in talking to some experts here today, and their system is different than the United States. The government really dominates legislature, so it's hard for a kind of a legislative rebellion here, although there are clearly some lawmakers who are want to remain in the EU, who are trying to scheme and figure out a way that they could push this country back, take that issue and take it back to the people. I think this is sort of one of these things with Brexit. You're going to have to take it day to day.
The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said today that the EU is going to intensify its preparations for a scenario in which Britain leaves the EU without a withdrawal agreement. How likely is that at this point, just a crash out?
You know, I think many people dread that. It is also a possibility. And I've spent, Sam, our producer, Sam Alwyn Mosley, and I, we've been traveling the country last week, actually going to the borders, talking to people. And there's a lot of concern that, for instance, at the Port of Dover, on the English Channel, possibly you could see on the 29th, veterinary checks, things like that for fish and other problems that could really cause huge backups. So it's not, it doesn't seem like it's exactly clear, and it's not clear exactly how the EU is going to respond to this. And most people here feel like the United Kingdom really hasn't planned for it. They thought that they would be able to work out some kind of deal.
Frank, just in the 30 seconds we have left, we can hear that you're right in the thick of it there. Where are you, and yeah. what is it like there at the moment after this historic vote?
I'm in Westminster Hall, and there are people now, a lot of people have been here today in the gallery to watch this historic vote, and they're beginning to make their way out. And just outside, there's huge demonstrations, particularly to remain in the EU.
That is NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. It sounds like tomorrow is going to be a very important day as well. The vote today, though, 432 against Theresa May's plan to leave the EU, 202 in favor. That vote went down. Frank Langfitt, thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Jeremy.
That special report from London, where Parliament rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan by a wide margin. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Let's turn back to the U.S. and the partial government shutdown, which has now entered its fourth week. 8,000 federal employees in Massachusetts are furloughed or working without pay. And rank-and-file Democrats rejected an invitation for a White House lunch with the president today. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark is vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus and plays a key role in negotiations to reopen the government going forward. We spoke with her as she was heading to the House floor. I started by asking her why Democrats turned down the president's offer to meet today.
Democrats are clear and unified in how this needs to be ended. We have to open up government. And I think that we have been clear. We have passed six Republican bills saying, let's open up government. Put a tight time restriction on Homeland Security so that we can negotiate border security, talk about immigration reform, but not at the expense of federal employees and our economy.
But isn't finding opportunities to negotiate, like a meeting with the president, a basic tenet of governing?
What we have here is a very unusual situation where we had agreement of both the House, the Senate, bipartisan agreement, and with the president to continue funding government and to have an ongoing discussion about border security. The president did an about-face on that back in December and caused this shutdown, which he proudly told us he wanted to do. We have been consistent. Let's open government. Let's open it for a short period of time to have these discussions with all the pressures of, a time-limited opening of government around Homeland Security so that we can have those negotiations. Our concern is if we don't have an open government as the first hurdle we need to get over, is that the next pet project, the next time conservative commentators come together and tell the president what they want him to do, we will be right back using this tool and the bludgeon on our federal employees for his next, policy that he wants. We want to get government open first, and we welcome a discussion around border security and immigration, but we have to have relief for those being impacted as the priority.
So what do Democrats want before face-to-face negotiations resume?
We want, have the government open. We've put forth 6 bills. We're going to be doing more this week. And we've been very clear. Let's have government open around Homeland Security for a short period of time so that we can come and negotiate. But what is unacceptable is that this president decided that he would put a campaign slogan ahead of the American people. And he proudly touted that this was his shutdown. And as this goes on into the 25th day, I can tell you the stories that I'm hearing from my district are heartbreaking. A woman in Natick who needs to have her income verified so she can keep her subsidized housing. A contractor in Cambridge who has a week and a half left of payroll before they are out of funding for those workers. These are the sort of real impacts that we're hearing from across my district and the Commonwealth and across the country.
So, the federal government expects to spend over $4 trillion this fiscal year. Compared to that, $5 billion is a tiny fraction, not even 1%. So why not give the president that money and bargain for a deal, say, on immigration to reopen the government and give relief to some of the constituents you were just talking about?
I think that is rewarding the president for holding the wall as a ransom payment. And our concern is if we were to do that and just say, fine, we are hearing so much pain and anguish from our constituents, we will just pay you off, that we will be back in this situation again with the next item on his agenda. This president has showed time and again that he lacks empathy, he lacks understanding of what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck, and we have to be clear that this is unacceptable. We're the only country in the world that, uses the shutdown in this way, and with this president who seems to believe he is only the president for a few conservative commentators and not for all the American people, we think that that is, rewarding very dangerous behavior. And what the president needs to realize is we will come and negotiate with him, but let's open government, keep the time pressure on all parties, and get back to work.
Congresswoman, what happens if you don't negotiate and the president uses emergency powers to build a wall anyway? At that point, will your resistance be all for naught, especially if you don't seize this time to bring other requests to the table, like immigration reform?
Well, I think that the president has, expressed that he is considering using emergency powers. I think that is also a dangerous course to take. It would be, a historical anomaly to have an executive use powers like that for, again, what was a campaign promise. And this wall has become a symbol. It is a symbol of the fear and division that the president was able to stoke during the campaign, and it is not part of a realistic, data-driven approach to keeping our borders secure. So, I would have great concerns with going forward with that. Let's have those again. Let's get government open. Let's make sure we're working towards solutions for these families and easing this pain, and then we can have those kind of discussions.
President Trump says the shutdown is justified because there's a crisis on the southern border. Do you see a crisis? What do you think should be done?
I think that we have a humanitarian crisis on our border, as we are seeing families coming. And much of what the president did with his separating families and taking children away from their parents has added to the anguish there. What we need to do is support smart, effective border security solutions. We need new technology to scan cars and trucks. We know that the overwhelming percentage of drugs that come through our borders come right through our ports of entry. Let's beef up our ability to detect and interdict those drugs. We need more personnel and better port of entry infrastructure to not only facilitate and help immigration and security, but to help with trade. It is the irony of this that while we are talking about border security, this shutdown of the president's is not paying our Border Patrol agents. It's not paying our TSA agents, the very people who we need and rely on to keep our borders secure. We are not going to be open to wasting billions of taxpayer dollars on an ineffective wall that can be tunneled under or climbed over or cut through, a wall that Mexico was always supposed to pay for, according to the president. But there are many things that we can do, incorporating new technology and some old technology, like making sure every Border Patrol agent has cell phone access, that we can use and put in place that can truly help protect our borders, ease some of the humanitarian crisis we're seeing at the border, and make sure that we are facilitating trade in our economy.
That's Representative Catherine Clark, Congresswoman for Massachusetts' 5th District and Vice Chair of the House Democratic Caucus. Congresswoman Clark, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Maria.
As the shutdown drags on, employees of the Federal Bureau of Prisons are among those deemed essential, meaning they're required to work without pay. One of the people who's still at it 5 days a week, 6 a.m. to 3 p.m., is David Martinez, a corrections officer at FMC Devens, a federal prison for men with medical and mental health needs in Harvard, Massachusetts. He's also the local chapter president of the American Federation of Government Employees, representing federal prison workers in New England. And David Martinez is on with us now. Hi, David. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
Hi. So you work as a correctional guard in a federal prison at FMC Devens, and you're considered an essential employee, so you're still going to work. What has it been like to be going in without pay for essentially the last month?
It's a stressful environment to begin with, and this has just added a whole level of anxiety and stress to everyone who works with me.
Well, we know many Americans live paycheck to paycheck, many times without savings, and a lapse in pay can be truly catastrophic for their homes. Is that the case for you? Can it turn into the case for you?
Being shortchanged on the check that just passed by, it's been difficult. It's definitely had an impact, and at the moment, there's no light in sight in terms of getting paid, so it's having an impact.
Can you give me a sense of some of the kinds of choices or perhaps sacrifices you and your family have had to make or are thinking of making to make ends meet while you wait to get paid?
Yes. So the obvious choices are you always pay the most important bills. The first and foremost is paying for your family, and this time of year, heat is a priority. Some of the kind of bills that you seek out your creditors to see if you can push them back or work with them is credit, to include your mortgage, other kind of sacrifices. In the grand scheme of things, little things get pushed to the side, like obviously the family can't eat out if that was something that we did often, or other buying choices, like if we wanted to buy some new clothes or something for the kids, that right now would be pushed off.
Your father, how have you talked to your kids about the financial strain and changes your family is facing and could be facing for more time?
Well, so I do try to instill in them the wisdom of being prudent with everything in the home, the electricity, water, and the food. And so I talked to them about the shutdown and that for the time being, money would be tight, and that, you know, they've worked with me on that. They're teenagers now, so they're a little wiser.
Hmm. Hearing Congresswoman Catherine Clark just now, it sounds like the Democrats aren't going to budge over the issue of the wall. President Trump has said he's not going to budge either. What do you make of that?
That's difficult to hear. One of the things is we have I have members who reside in the Congresswoman Clark's district. I have members who reside in four states in New England, and obviously a number of legislators are involved in those districts. And it's important that they get together, that the government's leadership gets together and resolves this budget impasse. It's important that they start to pay my coworkers and I for the work that we are performing, and we find it also important that they put to work the other agencies. Those employees have important jobs and representing their agencies, and it's important that they also get to work. So I expect Congress and the President to fashion some form of compromise to open the government fully and to do everything that's required to secure the country's borders.
How are you feeling about the country's leadership right now? Do you feel like you've
lost
faith?
I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that they can't come to a compromise. This country was based on compromise, and all they have to do is talk, and I'm sure that they could come up with something that would work.
Hmm. I also want to talk to you about your specific job. You know, at airports around the country, there's been a shortage of TSA agents because twice as many as usual have called out sick while they're not getting paid. You have a particularly, some would say, risky job and an essential one. Have you all experienced a lot of people calling out sick at FMC Devens?
It's definitely, I would say it's just a little higher. The thing about that we can't identify is this time of year a lot of people come down with colds and flus, but we haven't had the kind of issues that TSA has. We have not.
Hmm. So you also had the local union representing your coworkers. What are some of the individual stories that stand out for you when you think about those at risk?
You mean a reference to the job, or you mean a reference to the shutdown?
To the shutdown. I mean, how are people around you, how are your peers dealing with this?
Well, it's difficult. It has definitely affected morale. Working in prisons is very difficult to begin with. It's a stressful environment. This has only added to that. You also have to realize that when you come into a job like that where you want to be focused, but you come from home and you have all this anxiety of maybe you're short on gas today, maybe you're short on meal money, maybe there's some last minute expense propped up, like your car is not working as well. All these things are bringing stress into the environment that is already can be a pressure cooker. So it's not a good situation overall, which is why we have done everything we can to reach out to the media, to get our story out, to get Congress and the President to understand the mission that we perform.
David, what will happen to your coworkers and to the inmates at FMC Devens if your coworkers say, you know, enough with this, I'm not getting paid, I'm not coming into work?
In general, we look out for each other because it's such a dangerous environment. So we're going to have more resolve maybe than other workforces. But long term, of course, if people have to make those tough decisions, it's going to impact the public safety. I mean, we watch 1,000 inmates or more, and those inmates, they need our supervision, obviously. And it's our job to keep them safe and keep the public safe from them. And that's what we've done every day of the year, even though we're not getting paid now.
Hmm. Do you have a long-term plan if the shutdown continues for months or, say, even years, as President Trump has suggested he might let happen? Or do you have a certain due date when, say, you'll decide to leave your job at FMC Devens and look for something new?
So I have essentially worked for the government my entire life, first as a soldier in the Army, and now I have 20 years in the Bureau of Prisons. It would be difficult for me to leave ahead of the time that in my mind I had, you know, for retirement. But of course, there's going to have to be a day where I bring income into my home. And, you know, down the road, I mean, if this went on 5-6 months, I would definitely be having to look at that, because at that point, I would probably be past my breaking point, truthfully.
Hmm.
Well, even probably, to be honest, probably 2 months would probably be a breaking point.
Wow, 2 months. All right. Well, that's David Martinez, a corrections officer at FMC Devens, a federal prison in Harvard, Massachusetts, and the local chapter president of the American Federation of Government Employees, representing federal prison workers in New England. David, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Maria Garcia, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. It's no secret that housing is expensive in Boston, such that some residents are being driven out of their neighborhoods. That's why Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards, along with Councilor Kim Janey, has proposed a plan to generate funding for more affordable housing in the city and curb high-end developers' appetite for feeding off Boston's building boom. The proposal would levy a tax of up to 6% on commercial and residential real estate deals over $2 million, and a 25% flipping tax on properties that are bought and resold twice within 2 years. Councilwoman Edwards joins us in the studio now to talk about where her proposal fits in the city's goals for more affordable housing. Hi, Councilwoman.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course, we're happy to have you here. So what do you want to accomplish with the proposal?
Well, I just want to make a couple things very clear. It does apply to property sales of over $2 million, but owner-occupant properties are exempt from this. Mm. So that if you're living in the home and you're trying to build wealth within your family, you are exempt. The other thing I want to be clear is that the flipping fee or tax is up to 25%. It provides the city the flexibility. So it's not an automatic 25%. The goal is, I think you stated it earlier, which is really just saying we need to end speculation of our housing market, which has become today the new stock market. There are houses that are bought on Monday and sold on Friday at returns that you cannot even get on Wall Street, and barely a doorknob is being put on them. That inflates those prices. The flipping, the cost of flipping also creates an artificial inflation of those prices of those homes as well. And it's to our exclusion. And when I say our, I mean the middle class, the working class, folks trying to buy or even try to rent at a reasonable rate in Boston. What we consider affordable is not actually obtainable anymore. And people are genuinely suffering. We are in a housing crisis, and it's only getting exacerbated by essentially greedy speculators in our market.
So how much money do you expect this would generate for affordable housing?
We would expect potentially $175 million to $350 million. This is, again, for all transfers of $2 million or more. Many of them were $5 million or more in the commercial context. So that is expected based off of the housing sales between 2015 and 2017 of the amount of transfers over $2 million to $5 million, to potentially $10 million each. That's what our analysis showed us. So we're very comfortable saying that this is going to provide, and the money isn't just to go into general fund, it's to actually help with affordable housing.
And how specifically would it help with affordable housing?
We currently have a neighborhood housing trust that receives funds from Linkage, which is one form of construction, one form of gathering funds from housing development, and from IDP units. And that is then doled out to nonprofits, CDCs, developers who are going to build affordable units. Now, many people feel that what could be helpful is in those permitted units and those permitted buildings to buy down the affordability to really make it obtainable by some of our working class and some of our working poor. That's one way. The other way is to basically provide down payment assistance for folks who want to own a home. And the other way is to look at the already successful acquisition opportunity program the city of Boston has, which has been allowed CDCs to purchase at market rate triple deckers and keep them permanently affordable with the tenants in them. And what we need to continue to get to 1,000 units is 83 units a year. That's going to cost us about $7 million. And we don't have that on an annual basis to make sure that fund is fully funded. So we're already seeing wonderful opportunities that need the funds, and we think speculators need to start to pay in.
So earlier today, we spoke with Greg Vassell. He's the director of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. We spoke to him about this proposal, and he notes that there may be some what he calls unintended consequences with this proposal. For instance, in an effort to crack down on some of the luxury development, he says it could actually end up hurting affordable housing efforts. So let's listen to what he said.
A lot of this is focused, I think, on the resentment of some of the luxury construction that's happened. But, I mean, what about all the buildings that have inclusionary zoning that have affordable units in them that are going to be trading? Should you, from a bigger picture tax policy, continue to hit those buildings every time they're sold?
So have you taken that into consideration, how to avoid costs being passed on to tenants if taxes are added as buildings are bought and sold?
Yeah, we've taken that into consideration. We've taken a lot of the pushback, which is it's going to kill development. It's going to drive developers away from Boston. And my immediate response to a lot of these things is, so what is working or what isn't really working? And that's the build all you can as much as possible for as long as possible and hopefully it'll trickle down to the rest of us. That is not working. That is what we're doing right now. We are trying to build our way out of a housing crisis. So when I hear from folks who are concerned, quite frankly, about the fact that we're going to be killing development, that we are going to be punishing folks who are trying to do the right thing, I really wish they took that same fervor when it came to the amount of displacement that's happening for our middle class, even our businesses, from our working poor. I really wish that was where their focus was. And to be very frank, you know, this is the beginning of the conversation. We have exemptions right now in the ordinance. And if it makes sense to provide additional exemptions for so that a building that's already affordable gets traded to another affordable owner, then fine. Maybe then I'm happy to explore not having the fee apply to that if that's going to incentivize keeping the building affordable. Mm. So this is nothing that we can't adjust for. Whatever concerns that they're talking about, we can add exemptions to this. This is just a recipe right now where we haven't fully baked anything. It's looking at the exemptions. It's also looking at the percentages as well. We may want to start at $5 million instead of $2 million. This is all adjustable. But I think there's a fundamental agreement that we cannot continue the way we are. We do not have the funds, and we need money to create affordable housing, and we do not have enough.
Hmm. So what about this pushback that I'm sure you've already heard, that this could unintentionally hurt business in the city? Here's Vassil again.
People want to be in the city. Companies want to be in the city because they want to be around other companies that have smart people. And if you drive those costs and increase the rent that's going to get charged to those businesses, they're going to take a look and say, geez, I want to get outside of 128.
You know, so he's basically saying that this proposal could have unintended consequences, like essentially raising the rent for some people. Is that a concern for you? How might that in turn affect people's ability to afford housing?
I think that's interesting that raising the rent on commercial entities has been the top concern. I'm telling you, the rents are going up right now on regular people. I wish that same, again, fervor for concern about raising rents was applied to the average Bostonian who cannot afford to stay here. The families, the teachers, the police officers, the firefighters, the city workers that are required to live in the city of Boston are struggling to make it. So I don't really think that the concern about rising rents for commercial entities is something that I'm going to be focusing on. And I'm unapologetically going to be focusing on trying to keep Bostonians here in the city of Boston. And I think a business that really wants to be here will pay the price.
Hmm. The housing market is hot now, but what if we see a slowdown? Do you think this proposal will still be viable then?
That's, again, part of the drafting. We can look at sunset provisions. We can have an annual renewal. Mm-hmm. This does not have to be permanent and forever. We can adjust this language to make sure that we're capturing our income and the revenue during the boom. And if, for whatever reason, God forbid, we end up in a bust, we do not want to stop development. We do not want to stop people coming to Boston. And so we can actually say that this may not, we shouldn't renew it this year.
Hmm. So a lot of things have to happen before this proposal is approved. You mm-hmm. know, it must win the city council support. It has to be signed by the mayor.
Right.
And then it has to go to Beacon Hill, where the legislature has to approve it. How will you gain support for this proposal during all those levels?
Well, so I think that the support is already there in many cases. You will see there's already been Somerville's passed a version of it. Cambridge is working on their version. We have a version now in Boston. Newton, I just recently saw that their counselors might be working on a version. So it's caught fire in terms of the concept that developers are not paying their fair share, and we are the ones who are dealing with this. Are dealing with the burden of it. I want to also, I think the narrative that also is worth bringing to Beacon Hill is that those cities that I just mentioned, excluding Newton, Cambridge, Boston, and Somerville have built 65% of the new housing units in the entire state. We've done our fair share. We have built. We are asking now for compensation for the burden of building, overbuilding our communities to help house all of Massachusetts. And if Beacon Hill won't help us and build out in the suburbs, then maybe they can also help us with generating funds to make sure at least the the units we're creating are affordable.
So we know that the legislature is where things can get tricky. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw that happen with the Jim Brooks Stabilization Act, which would have helped track evictions in the city and notify tenants of their rights upon eviction. But the legislature ended up killing that bill. Are you worried that that could happen with this proposal?
I think that there's ways in which to look at it. This is a home rule proposal, which it's much higher than the current version, because Representative Mike Connolly already has a version. So I'll say thank you to Representative Connolly and Senator Boncori, who are introducing a statewide opt-in that allows for municipalities to opt into a version of this. It's at 2% total. This is at 6% for Boston. So I think the fact that Boston is trying to say, listen, we need in on this and we'll do it on our own, and the state is already pushing for it as a statewide legislation to opt in, and you have other cities, I just think that we're in a different narrative at this point. I think that I'm not concerned about them killing this. I'm concerned about whether they want to hear from the people who are truly suffering, who are desperate to stay in the city or desperate to stay in affordable housing. And I would flip it on that. Are they concerned about one day, if they choose not to take leadership on this, if they choose not to be part of this conversation and this solution, then maybe they should be more concerned about their jobs.
We're running out of time. 30 seconds here. Really quickly, the mayor set to give his State of the City address tonight. What do you hope to hear from him as far as housing is concerned?
I hope that he leads. I hope that he's speaking from a vantage point and perspective of our middle class, our working poor, our working class, and our poor individuals in Boston, and saying they are the ones, and their perspective and their recipe for how to house and live in an affordable community is going to be my guiding light. I will listen to them and then turn to the developers and turn to the money class and turn to the investors and say, follow their lead and tell me, as the mayor of Boston, what you need in terms of tax incentives or other acquisition opportunities, whatever you need for me to help you get to their goals and their dignified housing goals.
Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Ever hear the expression slow as molasses in January? It most likely comes from a remarkable and deadly disaster which took place right here in Boston exactly 100 years ago today. The Great Boston Molasses Flood of 1919. On a cold January day 100 years ago, a massive tank of the sticky sweet goo exploded in Boston's North End, unleashing a tsunami of molasses onto the streets. The wave trapped and killed 21 people, injuring hundreds more. And the aftermath of the disaster eventually led to important changes to how we construct and inspect buildings in America. Joining us now for more on the 1919 flood is Robert Allison. He's a professor of history at Suffolk University and the author of a number of books, including The American Revolution and A Short History of Boston. Professor Allison, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Maria. Great to be here.
So, Professor, let's back up from the explosion a bit, which really has become part of the lore of Boston. But set the scene for us. The North End on the harbor, a 50-foot high steel tank holding more than 1 million gallons of molasses. Why was the tank there?
The tank was there for the Purity Distilling Company to pipe the molasses over to Cambridge, where it had a processing plant. And, of course, the tank is on the waterfront, so the molasses could be unloaded directly from a ship. And it's on the edge of this very densely populated neighborhood, this time mainly Italian-American and Jewish, a very crowded neighborhood. The tank is there because it gives access to the harbor. And the ship, the tank had only been built about 3 or 4 years earlier, been put up kind of hurriedly just before the war, because this particular molasses was being used to make munitions, piped over to their plant in Cambridge to turn it into ethanol, which is an ingredient in all kinds of things. And in this case, they were making explosives with it.
So molasses, it was a controversial liquid, to say the least, you know, with historical connections to the Atlantic slave trade.
Yeah, sure, it was controversial, although it's really a necessary thing for lots of different purposes, rum, sugar, candy, etc. And there's also a bigger plant in Brooklyn, you know, molasses goes a long way toward making Boston what it is, because Boston was really a center for the production of sugar. In fact, we have the first candy factory in the country in the 1760s, and it is the trade with the West Indies, sending codfish to the West Indies and bringing back molasses to turn into rum, that really makes the 18th century economy of New England work.
So what was Boston like in 1919, and what was the North End like?
Boston was a very crowded place. It was still an industrial city. The great industries in Boston, really along the waterfront of the North End, Charlestown, South Boston, iron manufacturing, and so on, although Boston was in an economic decline for most of the 20th century. The things that kept Boston going were the two world wars. But other than that, the industries are moving out. They're upsizing, moving to places where they can build bigger plants, use electricity, and do other things. So Boston was a blue-collar city for most of the 20th century, and the North End is very much a blue-collar neighborhood. The Italians in the North End are either working in these small industries or they're fishermen. And it's a poor neighborhood. And one of the reasons you can put a molasses tank there is because these people aren't going to complain too much. I should also say that across the street, there was a plant that processed coal into gas, and Boston was lit with gas. We hadn't yet made the transition to electricity. So the old-timers in the North End still refer to the little park behind the parking garage as the gassy, because that's where the gas tank was. And so there was some concern as to having a gas tank in the middle of the North End. And in fact, the state reps from the North End were pushing to have the gas tank inspected, but the gas company said, well, the gas tanks aren't a problem at all. We've never seen one explode. And so there was, on the one hand, a natural fear of having a big tank of something that could explode right there in the North End. And on the other hand, the gas company dismissing these fears. And in fact, the state reps from the North End had pushed to have a hearing on whether there should be these gas tanks in these densely populated neighborhoods. And it was scheduled for the afternoon of January the 15th. Now, their argument that gas tanks are potentially dangerous gained a great deal of credence when a tank filled with molasses explodes, because who thought molasses could explode and kill 21 people?
Yeah. So I understand that this molasses tank was built there in 1915 by the Purity Distilling Company. And from our research, you know, we learned that it was built with a very quick deadline.
Very quickly.
So why did they build it so quickly, and why was it of such poor construction?
Well, they were in a hurry to get it done. And when you're in a hurry to get things done, you're going to cut corners. So the steel is a lot thinner than it should have been. And they never tested it to see if it could hold anything. Usually you build a tank, you fill it with water to see if it leaks. They never did that. They were in a hurry to get this done in 1915 so that they could start processing for the plant over in Cambridge. And so they get it done quickly, and it starts to leak. And people in the neighborhood see this brown ooze coming out of the rivets, and they say, look, the tank is leaking. And so the company simply paints the tank brown, so they won't complain because they can't see that it's leaking anymore. And there was actually a foreman who kept calling the company saying, you know, you really should do something about the tank. But the company, they thought he was kind of a tiresome nuisance. And the, you know, people in the neighborhood would go and scoop up the molasses from under the tank and take it home and use it to cook. They knew this was a source of molasses. So you have this leaky tank built because they could. And it was also in a time when Boston's, shall we say, the city inspectors were less conscious of the structure than of what you might give them if they look the other way. So there are a lot of corners cut for a variety of reasons. The company was in a hurry to get this thing up and so didn't want to spend the time making a good tank. And the city went along with this.
So let's go to that day. 100 years ago today, some reports have a wave of molasses flowing down Commercial Street at 35 miles an hour. 21 people killed. I mean, the sheer force of this is so hard to imagine.
It's really hard to imagine. And they describe the sound like machine gun fire as the rivets pop off of this tank. And it's at noon. A day or two earlier, a tanker from Havana had come, and the molasses on the ship is kept warm so that it can flow. there was already molasses in the tank, and during this cold winter days, it had pretty much frozen. And the thinking is that it was this warmer molasses that reacts with the cold molasses in the bottom of the tank, and it all expands, and that's what causes this. Just at about noon on January the 15th. So there are people eating lunch. There are a couple of kids in the area on their way home from school, and this thing explodes. And it not only has the molasses flowing, but it's pushing these steel plates in front of it. And there is an elevated trolley line along Commercial Street, and the plates hit that trolley track and knock it down. There's a trolley operator coming along the track from North Station is able to stop in time. There's a buildings across the street that are hit with this wave of molasses. It's now about 20 feet high. And it goes, you know, remember, it goes in a circle. The molasses doesn't just say we're going to go in this direction. It goes in all directions. So there's a firehouse for the fireboats on the harbor. That one is hit, and it's really knocked off of its foundation. And if one of the firefighter inside is crushed. He actually lives for most of the afternoon as the other guys are trying to rescue him before he succumbs. George Leahy, who's a firefighter, and there are a couple of kids, Pasquale and Tosco and Maria D'Estacio, are on their way home from school. Maria D'Estacio is with her brothers and sisters, and their brother is knocked under the molasses. They're able to pull him out. It's a very sticky substance, and you would look at this, you know, wave of molasses, and only if you could see some evidence of someone struggling would you know there was anyone in it. It just covers everything, and 21 people are killed, but we don't know how many horses are stuck in the molasses, and they have to be shot. And so we try to pull the animals out of this. It's really a catastrophe we haven't seen since, fortunately.
Right. Well, when I picture molasses, I picture this sort of dense, gooey, slow-moving liquid. How could it kill people? Like, what is the science behind how it sort of created these perfect conditions, essentially, to be so deadly?
Well, as you said, it's a 20-foot wall of molasses or wave of molasses, and you get hit with a 20-foot wave of anything, you're going to be knocked down. And then you're knocked down in this really thick, gooey stuff, and you can't get out. It's like quicksand. The more you struggle, the deeper you're going to go. And so, yeah, if you're standing up and are able to keep standing while the molasses runs over your feet, you'll probably be able to make your way out. But if it knocks you down, you're going to drown. So these people are drowned in the molasses.
Oh, my God. So what was the emergency response like?
The emergency response was actually very good. And it probably because we had just been through this war. And so there were a lot of people who had training in how you handle a crisis. So they did set up a health station in Haymarket Square. And so you could set up a medical facility there. Of course, the problem is everyone you were bringing is tracking the molasses with them. So this substance follows you. So getting the people there for triage is the first step. And shutting off the area and then trying to get the molasses into the harbor. One thing that's going to happen is the temperature starts to drop, and with that, the molasses hardens, so it's like concrete. And that's really a huge challenge. They have medical personnel who go to Haymarket to help with triage there. And here, the fire department has both a boat, a fire boat, and also an apparatus that you can actually see on Congress Street at the Fire Museum. Mm-hmm. It's a pumper they use to pump salt water onto the molasses to cut it and push it into the harbor. But also, you know, men with shovels. This is still a blue-collar city where you have a lot of guys who work with shovels and just trying to dig it out and push it into the harbor and clean it up in that way. It takes a long time. The EPA probably would not approve of pushing the molasses into the harbor, but I don't know what else you could have done with the molasses at that point.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of the conditions of Boston at the time, there was this tide of anarchy. And just a few years later, Sacco and Vanzetti were convicted and executed here in Boston. Could the explosion and flood have been caused by anarchists?
The company tried to argue that it was. And the anarchists are sending bombs to people. I mean, this is one of their modes of destabilizing the capitalist system, was sending bombs to people who are part of the system, including Oliver Wendell Holmes and newspaper publishers and others. And there were anarchists in the North End. Sacco and Vanzetti both had ties to the North End. So the company tried to argue this is a bomb. The company's trying to dodge responsibility. Doubtful, very doubtful that anarchists were involved in this, not to say there weren't anarchists around. And of course, the company's producing munitions. And one thing the anarchists are upset about is the United States is at war in Russia at the moment. And so they're trying to end the military-industrial complex. But it's really not plausible. The company is trying to dodge responsibility by saying that the anarchists did this.
Okay. Well, Robert Allison is a professor of history at Suffolk University. He's the author of a number of books, including The American Revolution and A Short History of Boston. Professor Allison, thanks so much.
Thank you, Maria.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Maria Garcia. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.